I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And this is Building Bridges. And Miles is asking, so what? Well, we're going to tell you so what, because sparks are flying as Congress tries to force Biden's contract down the railroad workers' throats. The current move by President Biden and Congress to impose a contract on 115,000 railroad workers, a contract that the members of rail unions representing the majority of those workers have rejected. It's an unconscionable attack on rail workers, the labor movement, and the entire U.S. working class.
The right to strike is a fundamental human right and one of the most effective tools working people have to win justice from the greedy railroad bosses and capitalist oligarchs who increasingly seek to control not only our economy and our government, but every aspect of our lives.
Railroad workers are fighting for basic human freedoms. Harkening back to the Memphis striking sanitation workers' demands to recognize their humanity and to be treated with dignity expressed on their picket signs, they carried, "I am a man."
So join our virtual picket line now in support of the railway workers led by J.P. Johnson, former French conductor, now locomotive fireman at Amtrak and steering committee member of Railroad Workers United. Paul Lindsay, Union Pacific rail engineer and steering committee member of Railroad Workers United. Mary Lee Taylor, freight engineer, and Maximilian Alvarez, editor-in-chief at the Real News Network, covering labor disputes.
And thank you all for being here. And we're making this into our virtual labor rally. So I hope everybody's got their picket signs held high. And it's not just for the union bosses at this point. It's clearly for the Congress as well and the president. You know, the current move, Maximilian, by President Biden and Congress to impose a contract on our nation's 115,000 railroad workers, a contract that the members of rail unions representing the majority of those workers have rejected. Well, we said it already, but we'll say it again. It's an unconscionable attack on rail workers, the labor movement, and the entire U.S. working class. But how did we get to this point with a president that proclaims his sensitivity and affection and support for organized labor? How did we get to this point? And thank you all for the work that you do and joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. It's a real honor to be on the call with everyone here. And I think that it's a really fascinating question, right? How did we get here, right? Because I think the thing to stress to everyone listening, as I and everyone on this call has been trying to do in as many interviews as we possibly can, is that this is not a problem that just came up now. The crisis on the freight railroads in this country has been brewing for years, if not decades. That crisis has in no way been addressed by President Biden and Congress by their actions this past week to force a contract down railroad workers' throats. A contract that, as you mentioned, the majority of rank-and-file workers, over 50%, voted down in the preceding months. And I think that, you know, as far as Biden goes, you know, like, it comes down to, I think, a fundamental misunderstanding of what the problem actually was, right? You know, I know that in recent weeks and months, you know, the public has gotten more invested in the story, as well they should have, especially because, you know, it's such a clear-cut story of heroes and villains, right? You have essential workers holding up our nation's supply chain, being worked to the bone, being run into the ground, many workers on call 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and yet they have no paid sick days. And yet they're complaining about never getting to see their families, missing funerals, missing their kids growing up, and all of that stuff. So we have a very sympathetic, very essential workforce against rail carriers. That is the companies that own the rail, the companies that own the major freight carriers, who are raking in record profits and to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, spending billions more on stock buybacks and shareholder dividends than they've been spending in investments in rail infrastructure, and all the while cutting staff to the bone year after year after year, reducing their operating costs so that they can siphon off more profit from this essential part of our supply chain. So frankly, this should have been a political slam dunk for Biden and the Democrats, because who's going to sympathize with Warren Buffett making billions of dollars more than he already is at the expense of rail workers who never get to see their families? But the problem is that Biden really didn't care enough about what the actual problem is. He didn't have, you know, I think the backbone to stand up to the rail bosses who are in control of one of the most profitable industries in the country. And instead, you know, he just approached this in a sort of old world vein, thinking that the real problem was just that, you know, workers needed a little more money on the salary front, you know, maybe like a couple of contract sweeteners to give them a little more flexibility with their scheduling. But ultimately, all the problems that have been leading workers to quit the industry in record numbers, that have been leading people to die on the job from heart attacks and stress, even suicide, none of that has been addressed by Biden or Congress. So they've essentially just rubber stamped the entire scheme that the rail carriers have been pushing on the railroads for decades, and we are all worse off for it.
What needs to be added? What is your agreement or disagreement? J.P. Johnson, Paul Lindsay, Mary Lee Taylor. Let's start with Paul Lindsay.
I believe that all of us seem to unify around the idea of paid sick leave, even though that was not the top issue necessarily at stake. The top issue was just quality of life as a whole, which this tentative agreement actually basically laid open wide our longstanding agreements that we've had for decades, and basically gave these corporations the ability to gut our agreements and put us on call to even worse schedules, and I'd say we are now. However, we all seem to unify around the idea of paid sick leave, which is something that our country is sorely lacking behind countries around the world, countries that are far smaller than us, GDP-wise, that are able to put forward paid sick leave for their employees. However, we are not, for any of our employees. Our country does not have that. So we have unified kind of around that as a major issue. However, there are others, like, for example, one that I like to push heavily on is the fact that we do have very real, very significant meal expenses when we travel out of town. And during the Trump administration, when the tax law was changed, one of the more unknown provisions is it kind of took away our ability to itemize anymore. It rearranged some deductions and exemptions and doubled the standard deduction and got rid of the personal exemption and made it to where we cannot itemize anymore. So we can't count up how many trips we were gone away from home and write off our meals anymore. And yet the railroads have not raised our daily per diem amount since the 90s. So it's slightly different at different railroads and different crafts, depending on whether you're a conductor or an engineer. But for me, as an engineer for Union Pacific, I can be gone for 2 days, and I make $12 for my non-taxable meal allowance. Every other portion of my pay is, I would argue, at least unethically, possibly illegally, subject to taxation, because the IRS says I should be getting $60 a day, and we get $12 per day. I can't even eat one meal with a tip for that much. Of course, we know how people feel about these companies seem to feel about the service sector and those employees, so they could probably care less whether I'm able to afford a tip for them. But that's another issue that I really would like to put forward. This contract did not give us any increase to our unreimbursed meal allowances while out of town. So that's another one of the issues. Another one is self-protective pools, which is a very, very deep issue. If one of my colleagues with RW wants to cover one of those issues.
Yeah, let's also pick up on Marilee Taylor, who was a freight engineer and one of the few women, and which I'd like to also bring up, why are there so few women now in the industry, so to speak? But how do you understand, I mean, how have you been affected in terms of what you did as a woman on the job, as a worker on the job? What does it mean when you talk about the quality of life? And how do you understand why there was no pressure essentially put by Congress on the bosses? It all went to the workers.
Well, those are about, I could talk on 40 minutes for each one, so I'm going to try to, before I lose my voice here. First and foremost, in terms of the self-protecting pool that Paul raised, I do want to talk to that a little bit, because I think this is a very benign-sounding phrase that will, in fact, force us to incur even a bigger ravaging of the workforce, doing more work with less people, because of the way it works. The whole point of a so-called self-relieving pool, and we have been living under that on the BNSF out of the Chicago area where I worked, and I did retire earlier this year after 34 years on two railroads. But that, getting back to the question of these of what does it actually mean? It means that the railroads are going to not use extra lists to fill job vacancies. So if I take today off because I'm losing my voice and I can't even talk on the radio, the guy behind me, it doesn't go to the extra board, so the guy behind me's place stays where it should be in terms of how when he expects to go to work. Instead of that, they're pushing him up. So what that means in the concrete for us in the freight rail side of the industry, the pool side of the industry, is that we have absolutely no idea that when we're going to work, and it can change in any minute, and we, whether we've slept or not, whether we're sick or not, whether our immediate family's ill or whatever, we still must take the call and go to work under these attendance policies. So it's a real multiple body slams that we are suffering from this agreement that was imposed on us in a totally undemocratic and, in my opinion, tyrannical, imperial manner that the president appears to think that he is something different than simply an elected president, that he can wield this power without ever having taken no one has taken into account the real conditions, the erosion of the conditions on the railroad, the forced work, the unsafe nature that this has created, the lack of our home lives, the lack of even being able to be guaranteed more than 24 hours off in a 30-day period while we remain all the rest of the time on call, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, where we have no idea when we're going to work. So our original, and I call them the operating crafts, the engineers and conductors that actually move the freight from one city to another in toward its destination. So those of us have raised immediately being able to take unpaid time. We weren't even beginning to raise in a huge way. I think we had proposed some days for paid leave, but we can't even take unpaid leave. That's the situation that we come down to. And I fully support every worker in this country should be getting 15 days paid leave. This is ridiculous, 2022. And I support the fight for rail workers to get paid leave. One of our fellow unions had begun that process. I believe the Maintenance of Way Union, the guys that work on the track and maintain the buildings and stuff, had already some sick leave, and it's not enough. It's not enough. They work outside in all weather, and they're subject to the same in horrible conditions when they're away from home, many cases. Horrible conditions. They should absolutely, whatever they, it should be five times that for somebody that works in those conditions. And we want paid leave too, but we also want to be able to take time off when we're tired, sick, whatever reason that we need in order to conduct the business of living our actual lives, which we have been deprived of, with the threat of being put on the street after three alleged incidents of taking off more than a 24-hour period within a month.
For real? For real? I mean, you talk three incidents?
Yes. The first incident on BNSF, you will be hit with 10-day suspension, served suspension. The second time, a 30-day suspension. I mean, the second time, and the third time, dismissal. You're on the street.
Wow.
You're on street.
And so, these aren't even contractual issues. These aren't even issues that were raised. This onerous, egregious, hostile, punitive system to discipline workers who are asking for fundamental needs. Wow, wow. So, am I glad you're all here to tell us about this?
And that's why you see the deep anger. And the willingness on the part of workers in their thousands, well beyond rail workers, to stand up and, along with us, fighting the government and fighting the rail carriers, which at this point in time, to my mind, they look the same.
Can I just ask you one question about, just to bring in another element? As I said, there are not, I don't know what percentage of women make up the workforce in these various unions of this 115,000 or so workers, but I know it's small, and I'm sure there are very few that, like yourself, Marilee, are freight engineers. But were there particular things in terms of when women of childbearing age and so on who had, was there any consideration of any health benefits relevant to women's needs on the job, which is maybe one of the reasons there aren't more women working in these occupations?
Well, I could talk for years about that too, but I think the main thing is that we as rail workers are so up against the wall. Regardless of whether we're male or female, regardless of what nationality we are or what our first language is, we are so up against the wall as a mass of humanity with these oppressive policies that the question of if they're this reactionary on the question of the basic human rights, I don't think that they would be particularly amenable to negotiating on any questions that may even further affect women, especially of child-rearing age. There is no maternity. I mean, you could take, by federal law, you can use the federal law for time off work for being pregnant. You could use the federal the Family Medical Leave Act, which is unpaid, to do that. But without that federal law, there are no provisions within our contracts to be off for anything like that. And in fact, if you were really sick, you could run out of the maximum FMLA time allotted to you, which is 84 days, very quickly before the birth of your child. So, yeah, these are big issues. How they, I was talking to a maintenance away guy out of, I get these Midwest states messed up, but I think it was Kansas City, whichever, whether that's Kansas or Missouri, it must be, but anyway. And he was telling me that he seems to think that the railroads are hiring fewer people of color as well. So that may well be going on. I don't have any figures on it, but the railroad has always reflected the society that it lives in or the society it operates in, and it is hard for women to break into non-traditional jobs. It was very hard for me. I started out on the railroad in 1987 in Atlanta, Georgia, on the Norfolk Southern Railroad as a brakeman, conductor assistant, kind of. And I was written up in the UTU News because this was such a major event. That was our national union newspaper. They put in a little blurb by local, said, "Oh, you're going to be good. We're going to put this in." But I was it. I was the first woman in road service they had ever seen, they'd ever had.
Well,
I could just, I wish we could just sit around and drink a glass of wine, put our feet up, and celebrate having won this battle in front of us. And we could tell tales until the cows come home, because it would be very I think enjoyable for you and me.
I don't know about you, but I've got the glasses out here because I insist that we will win, we will win, we will win. And we've got the listeners to make it so, because we've got to involve the community in this struggle. And we've got to have more and more labor community struggles. But, Ken, I know you were interested in hearing also from
J.P. Johnson.
Yeah.
Who recognized the situation years ago and quit the freight side and became a locomotive fireman for Amtrak, which is a publicly held corporation. So what do you have to contribute to your views on the terrible congressional action that we've experienced over the last week or two?
Well, first of all, thank you guys for having me on. And something to what Mary Lee said, when I was working as a conductor in freight, and I was a qualified on-the-job trainer, my best students were always women. They seemed to have they were always the ones that came to work hard and always knew the roles and everything, and they knew what was in front of them, and they were always the toughest. So I know exactly what Marilee's saying there about that. But to your question, Ken, the whole thing is just a giant slap in the face to everybody, whether you're in passenger or freight service. And it sets the precedent that these companies know now that the government will back them up for whatever they want to do. Now that they were able to get the president to force this contract down the freight railroad's throats, and it also sets a precedent in the negotiations for our contract with Amtrak. I'm not saying that the same thing's going to happen, but precedents have been set. And then also, the administration has also released a lot of, I would say, propaganda that makes the railroad workers out to be, you know, the old term was feather bedders, which means that they were, you know, we were getting all this, we're getting all this money, you know, and we're living the life of Riley, if you will, and they are letting the news outlets paint us as such. And it's absolutely sickening when these commentators get on and say, why are these guys wanting to strike? They got nothing to worry about. You know, they're getting a 24% raise. Ken, that raise doesn't even cover cost of living over the next 5 years. None of this. They don't ever, the carriers always forget about cost of living. And they can, you know, they give us, well, you know, we'll give you this, this, and this, but cost of living is not figured into it. And as my colleague Paul Lindsay just said, it has to do with the away from home meals. And like I said, they're getting away with absolute murder. And on top of that, the administration's painting us out to be a bunch of greedy people, but we're not. We're struggling here. It's like a second Gilded Age with the robber barons and a very weak labor movement on the parts of the unions. I'm not saying that there's a weak labor. There's a very strong grassroots labor movement, and I assume that that's going to be gathering more and more and more headway as this continues. And I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to see some wildcat strikes happen where people on our railroads just decide, you know what, I'm marking off. We're all marking off in mass until something is done. And I would hope that that would happen, because it's the only way we're going to put a damper on things as far as the carriers and the corporations. There has been calls by today, Reuters put out an article about certain stockholders making motions at the stockholder meetings that are upcoming. I believe Union Pacific's is upcoming soon. Am I correct, Paul?
Yes, that's correct.
They are making motions that in the actual stockholders' meetings that, you know, paid sick leave be included. But we don't really know if these are major stockholders that are making these motions. But it is obvious that it is hitting some people in Wall Street, hitting home with some people in Wall Street. But it could be just the minor stockholders, and they'll get yelled down at their meeting. Hmm. So I'm not expecting anything great and grand from that. But at least the voice is getting across a little bit to Wall Street here.
Well, you know, but talking about Wall Street, JP, you know, one of the things that just a couple of numbers that I did a little research on, the railroad companies in recent years laid off, well, they've laid off like 45,000 workers. But in the first three quarters of this year alone, they made $21.2 billion in profits. Let me say that again. $21.2 billion in profits in the first three quarters of this year. And not only that, the scoundrels, but you know, they've had buyback. Well, let's see. I wrote it down here. Yeah, the issue of the railroad company since 2010 handed over $200 billion in stock buybacks and dividends.
Those numbers are unconscionable. I mean, they're absolutely, yeah. And yet we're down here crawling on our bellies, trying to scratch away a living while they're stepping on our heads and rubbing us into the dirt with their record profits. It's unconscionable and it's unacceptable, absolutely unacceptable.
And Ken and I are going to say, as we usually do, workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains.
And a world to win.
And indeed, that's the case. Railroad Workers United, support them. Support all the 115,000 railroad workers. And you make your Congress people know that you are sick of their being scabs. We want to especially thank Marilee Taylor, J.P. Johnson, Paul Lindsay, Maximilian Alvarez from The Real News, our compatriot organization. Thanks for listening. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And stay strong. Support the working class.
This has been part one of a two-part program on Railroad Workers United. Tune in next week when we focus on what needs to be done by all of us to fight back.